The theater. The theater.
Bring out Louis.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Dudes, yeah. Friends,
yeah.
I'm glad you're back.
I just want everyone to know before we start that I have a breakdown for this.
Jesus Christ.
Christ, Jesus.
Good.
In case anyone wants a breakdown, I have.
You
a
did your homework. Thanks.
Right.
Yeah. No, we appreciate that. I'm excited to hear your breakdown later.
Yeah.
When you have a breakdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a breakdown, shake down, take down.
Anybody? A couple things. No, sorry, Scott. I'm moving on from that. Just kidding. There was two things we wanted to talk about.
Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Of course. Of course.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry for interrupting.
I always get the Fletch theme song and the Beverly Hills Cop theme song mixed up.
Oh, the Beverly
They're
Hills
similar.
Cop 1. Do, 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 that very 80s.
Yeah.
There's one guy with a keyboard. He's got a Casio keyboard. And he's...
Isn't it? It's got to be like a guitar or something, right? I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
but
know,
Fletch
maybe.
Has a similar vibe.
Yeah,
Fletch
it does.
Has that sort of like...
Definitely does. Yeah, for sure. Anyway. I'm sorry.
Fletch.
Digressions. Yeah.
I haven't seen either of them.
Speaking of movies, that's okay. You don't need to. Speaking of movies, I purchased the three of us tickets to something that obviously you don't have to go with me to, but I brought it up on the podcast a long time ago that I was going to make you guys do this. There's a remaster of Old Boy coming out.
Oh, it's the original, remastered. Thank God.
Yeah. The original Park Chan-wook, Old Boy. And it's one of my favorite movies.
It's fucking great.
It's a retelling of The Count of Monte Cristo, and it's pretty dark and disturbing, but it's like not any more dark and disturbing than I think a lot of things we've engaged with on this podcast, including the play we're reading today is much darker than anything that happens in Old Boy. But we're gonna go see it, Scott and I, and CJ, I got you a ticket. You do not have to come.
I think I was booking tickets for Spider-Verse or something at 11 o'clock at night, and I opened up my app and I was like, Old Boy on the 20th. What? I did not sign up for this. And I immediately texted Bailey and was like, what the fuck is this, Bailey?
That sounds like a dream I have where sometimes I just open the app and there's free tickets to Old Boy in my cart.
Yeah. Was it U2 that gave us their album for free on iTunes?
Sons of bitches.
Is it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm still mad
Old
about
Old Boy
that.
Really wants me to see it. I will say I did the Heather Schmidt cheat, which is I can't watch scary or creepy movies, but I like to look them up on Wikipedia and read their plots.
It's not scary. I would never, ever classify it as horror.
No.
It is a action thriller that has dark elements
with mental horror towards the end, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's.
Are you referring to the twist of the movie? Is that what you're talking about?
Because
I guess that is traumatic, horrifying things, but it is not ever set up as a horror film.
No.
Right.
No.
You know? It's
right.
Count of Monte Cristo. It's a revenge thriller.
It's a philosophical meditation on revenge. Mm-hmm. And.
It's the third in the trilogy of the revenge trilogy that he's written, which is Mr. Vengeance, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance,
Old Boy,
and this one, I believe.
Yeah.
Why Old are Boy. We so focused on revenge, everybody?
Well,
I
that's the whole point of his movies. Why are we so focused on revenge? He basically does what
See
Spielberg
the
tried
Batman?
To do. What?
I'm vengeance.
I'm vengeance.
I am vengeance.
You're wearing a lot of eyeliner for vengeance.
I just think he is so handsome.
He's great.
He's great. I like
him.
There was something else we wanted to talk about before we got into it. What was it? I forgot.
We need people to write in and send us their theater nightmares.
Thank you. Yeah, so my next pick, the next Bailey pick, is Theater Nightmares Part 2. Part 2.
Can't wait.
Have you ever seen Hot Shots Part 2?
Oh, yeah.
It's better than Hot Shots. It's better than the first one.
Yeah.
Is Hot Shots like a basketball movie or something?
No.
What is
it? It is a spoof comedy, like silly spoof comedy with about the Navy, maybe?
Yeah, it's about a spoof of action. Or it's Marines? Action movies. It's spoofing Top Gun and all those 80s action flicks.
Right.
And
it's what's his name? It's
the brothers who did Airplane and all that, I think.
Tom Skerritt?
No, but it's a...
Oh, Nielsen.
Emilio Estevez's brother.
Oh, Charlie Sheen. What is his name? Charlie Sheen.
Oh, right.
My God. I could not think of his name to save my life. Star of Platoon, Charlie Sheen. Mm-hmm. Star of Two and a Half Men, Charlie Sheen.
Mm-hmm.
We stand a legend, right? He never did anything wrong.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. No.
We should do a
totally
bonus
normal.
Episode on him.
Just on Sheen?
Yeah.
Charlie?
Yeah. I've worked with Charlie, so.
Hey.
How was he?
he was perfectly nice. He was a little too cool for school, which made perfect sense in this little indie thing that I was doing. But
did he hit on you?
No, but we had our scene in a van with Playboy Playmates and adult film actors, and that was a little crazy.
Oh, you were in the YouTube video that he made when he went on his bender. That's what you're talking about. Got it.
No, I wish I was. No.
Was like, yeah, he must have been in Seventh Heaven in
it
that
was,
van.
It was, interesting. Yeah, we'll talk more about it someday. Yeah.
I thought you were referencing the old TV show Seventh Heaven, and I was like, whoa.
And then which is a batshit Saturday Night Live.
Batshit crazy show.
My dad loved that show. Loved
even
it.
After
Watched
Stephen
it
Collins? Even
no,
after
he,
Stephen
no,
Collins?
He didn't.
Oh, okay.
No.
Yeah.
Now he loves, like, Charmed.
Sure.
Yeah.
All the old UPN shows, great.
It's
love it.
Adorable.
Welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. This week we're back with our part two of our mini-series covering the works of Martin McDonagh. And we're calling it three podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah, here we go. We got back to it. It was a long hook.
Great title.
Yeah.
Great title.
Swag.
And last week we covered Beauty Queen of Lenon. This week we're covering The Pillow Man. And next week we're covering Hangman. So read Hangman before next time. If you haven't read Pillow Man, hopefully we can inspire you to read Pillow Man. But before we do that, there's something we like to do, which is the chronology of his work.
Yes.
What?
Chronology.
Okay. Now, the way I'm going to do this is a little bit different because I'm going to go a little bit out of order because I want to introduce you to trilogies at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Cool.
So last week we covered The Beauty Queen of Lenon. That comes out in 1996. We discussed it there. We talked about all of its off-Broadway at the Atlantic and it was in Galway and it did all these things. It also did go to Broadway and was nominated for Tony Award for Best Play, which you said, Scott, and I said, no, it didn't, but you were correct. I'm wrong.
Oh,
I'm stupid.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Now, he writes another play that same year, which is The Cripple of Inishmen, but that is not part of this trilogy. So I'm skipping that.
I feel like that's the title I see the most by him other than Pillow Man. And
Lieutenant of Inishmore and Cripple of Inishmen are the two that I see most colleges putting up.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, you know, cooler regional theaters. You know?
Right.
More hip regional theaters.
Yeah.
But the second part of the Beauty Queen of Lenon trilogy, which is technically the Galway trilogy.
Yeah. I think that's County. County Galway.
Galway County, yeah. It's called A Skull in Connemara, and it's about a man who is employed to exhume skeletons in an overcrowded graveyard.
Ooh.
And he ends up encountering the wife who he was once accused of killing.
Wow.
That's a good Halloween play.
It sounds kind of great. It premiered in 97 at Town Hall Theater in Galway and ended up going to the Royal Court Theater, ended up in Seattle, and then finally off-Broadway at the Roundabout Theater, which we love Roundabout in 2001.
Roundabout's not even really off-Broadway. That's just kind of like at the corner of off-Broadway and Broadway. The Roundabout's like... Right. Legit, like,
and Roundabout also produces like on Broadway sometimes. Like, I think this so this was at the Gramercy Theater, produced by Roundabout. Right, yeah. And then the third in this trilogy did write also the same year as Skull and Connemara. It's called The Lonesome West, and it's a play involving two brothers who are bickering in the aftermath of the supposedly accidental fatal shooting of their father. So that ran on Broadway in 1999, even though he wrote it in 97. Runs on Broadway in 99 and receives a Tony Award for, a Tony Award nomination for Best Play in 1999. Best year for film. Then there's another whole trilogy that begins with his 1996 play, The Cripple of Inishman. Now, this is called the Aran Islands trilogy, or the Aran Islands, or I don't know actually how to pronounce that. A-R-A-N Islands trilogy. So
it might Cripple of Inishman. Aran.
It might be Aran. Yeah. I'll say Aran. The Cripple of Inishman is a dark comedy, in which most of these tend to be, in which a crippled teenager schemes to attain a role in the movie documentary Man of Aran. And it opened in 1997 at the Royal National Theatre in London, went off Broadway in 98 at the Joseph Papp Public. And then in 98, Frederick Kohler?
Kohler.
I don't know him, played the title role at Geffen Playhouse in LA.
Cool.
So that was in 98. And then in 2008, it was produced at the Atlantic Theater off Broadway with the Druid Theater Company of Galway. We've met them before. Mm-hmm. And then the second comes out in 2001. So he takes a break after Lonesome West in 97, takes a big break, and then writes the second in this other trilogy. So this is The Lieutenant of Inishmore.
Mm-hmm.
It's a follow-up play, which was written as a response to the 93 Warrington bombings, where two children were killed by the IRA. Mm. And it's a dark comedy, once again, in which the leader of the Irish National Liberation Army, Splinter Group, discovers that his best friend, a cat, has been killed. This is produced off-Broadway. People love this one.
Yeah, this is the one that everybody didn't want to do. It was finally the RSC that did it because they were afraid of repercussions from the IRA because of that.
Right.
Which is, you know, terrifying and interesting. But yeah, I weirdly have read that, but not the other one. So, I mean, he says trilogies. I think he's working in a more... general
thematic trilogies.
Thematic trilogies.
It's sort of like August Wilson's whole, you know, he has those, is it 10 plays?
The Pittsburgh cycle.
Pittsburgh, right? But it's like, they're not technically sequels to each other. He's not having a bunch of recurring characters. There's a couple.
They have a handful of recurring characters.
There's a couple, but in theory, he's building a world more than he's building a universe of characters.
Right.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We're living in the world. Like, in
he's
theory,
building an experience.
Right. And I think in theory, someone from Cripple of Inishmore could walk into Lieutenant of Inishmore and be right at home, but they're not, like, true... sequel following the same person.
Sure.
Right? Like we're used to in like film franchises and things.
Right, yeah.
But then, so Lieutenant of Inishmore also gets a Tony Award nom for Best Play in 2006 after being written in 2001. Then the third of that trilogy is the unproduced Banshees of Inisherin. which is a play he basically never, he finished, but then never produced it. And whenever people asked him about it, he's like, it's just not good. I'm not going to put it up. And then he made the movie in 2022, Banshees of Inisherin. And when people sort of asked him, like, what's, you know, is it the same script? Is it that he's sort of like, yeah, not really. And you're like, okay. Like,
all right.
And it's like, it was probably thematically similar with in a whole new plot or something. And he was just like, this is a movie, and made the movie. But kind of interesting, because that all happens in 2022, right? Way after all these other things. But that's unproduced. You can read the screenplay, but we don't really know its relation to the original material. Then you have The Pillow Man, a play that we're talking about today, which we'll get into later. And then in Pillow Man, by the way, is 2003. Then in 2010, he takes another big break, probably when he like meets Phoebe Waller-Bridge or whatever, and starts fucking so much that he can't do it. And then so A Behanding in Spokane comes out in 2010.
Which I really want to read. I'm really intrigued by it. Yeah, because, and it'll lead me to a question later on about his writing of dialect and dialogue and how that's different for a play that he sets in America as opposed to the Irish plays, as opposed to Pillow Man, which I think is distinctly British in its language and rhythm.
Now, a reminder, Behanding in Spokane comes out in 2010. He writes it in 2010 and goes up on Broadway in 2010. So he has made a name for himself enough that he can get this to straight to Broadway. He made In Bruges, which he did not direct but wrote, in 2008, which is 2 years before this. So he's created a relationship with Colin Farrell, and he is now in Hollywood. He's part of Hollywood now, 2008. Okay. 2010, Behanding in Spokane, a play in which the character of Carmichael has been searching for his missing left hand for a quarter of a century.
To backtrack real quick.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Just want to shout out, I love In Bruges. It took me like two or three viewings before I really, maybe my favorite Ralph Fiennes performance. He's fucking great. Ralph Fiennes playing dumb is beautiful. Anyway,
all right.
I'm sorry for the digression.
Yeah, I remember that performance. Yeah, he is fantastic in that. Grand Budapest is a kind of perfect.
Yeah, he's fantastic
thing. So it's hard to, but I agree with you. Behanding was nominated for 2010 Drama League and Distinguished Production of a for the Distinguished Production of a Play, did not win. So he's not winning anything yet. He hasn't won any Tonys. He has nothing. Right. Then in 2012, he does Seven Psychopaths, a movie I love.
It rules.
I love that movie so much. Harry Dean Stanton. Rip.
Yeah.
It is fantastic. And it's a really great film. Everyone should check it out. Then in 2015, he does Hangman, which we will cover next week.
Mm-hmm.
So come back for that. Then in 2017 is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which he wins the Oscar for. So now he has no Tonys, but he has an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
Did he win for screenplay for that?
Correct.
Because he'd won, I don't know, but I know he'd won a Best Short Film Oscar for his original directorial.
That's right.
Thing.
That's in 2004. Yeah. He wins for Six Shooter. That's true. It. I forgot about that. That's his short. I forgot.
Then I think Good he call. Won for yeah, I think so he won for screenplay for Billboard. I hope he did. Yeah, we'll figure
yes.
it out.
Yes. I could. No, maybe he just was nominated.
Maybe.
He might have just been nominated because Frances McDormand won.
What's his name?
And
won.
Sam Rockwell won. Woody was nominated. Maybe he didn't win. Am I crazy? I've been way off on my Oscar trivia recently.
No, it looks like it. No, it looks like it was just he's he only has he's He's got the one Oscar.
That's batshit crazy, because that, right? That script rules. Anyway, he wrote and directed, and I guess he did direct In Bruges. I didn't realize that. So he has written and directed everything that he has done. So he wrote, directed In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths, 2017, Three Billboards, gets some Oscars. Then 2018 is A Very, Very, Very Dark Matter, which is a play I own and have not read and have always wanted to read, and now I'm going to read it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels like a bit of a sequel to Pillow Man in some ways, or a sister play, because it's set in a townhouse in Copenhagen that reveals the dark source of the tales of children's author Hans Christian Andersen, as well as of the writer Charles Dickens. Sounds good.
Yeah, sounds good.
Premiered at the Bridge Theatre London in October 2018. And then he does Banshees of Inisherin. So, you know, he's on an upswing right now. He's going to keep making shit. He'll probably keep writing plays. He'll probably have a movie every 5 years for the next foreseeable future, which is great. And I love what he does. I love his movies. Banshees was one of my favorite films of that year.
Yeah, he's what's fascinating, and what's been fascinating in doing the research and doing the reading for this is how, I don't know how to say this, how broad and narrow he is at the same time. He creates such distinct characters and such intimate moments dealing with these sort of big floating ideas and themes and things that get under your skin that bother you, like, but then you're laughing the whole time too. It's really this unique little juggling act that he does, and I think in Pillow Man, he, as we get into this, that he really does a great job of the tightrope walk of all the stuff that he's sort of setting out to do, or what I think he's setting out to do, with it, and pulls it off. Like, he's smart. He's a smart guy. Smart playwright. Real good. Real good.
Yeah. Real good there.
Real good.
Well, that's my chronology. So why don't we... Why don't we do a pivot into what the play that we're talking about today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
CJ.
Yeah. Oh, is it time?
Break that shit down.
Yeah.
CJ's Breakdown.
Katurian, a haunted author that writes short stories that are mostly gruesome tales of child abuse and murder, is being held in police custody in a totalitarian state. He and his equally haunted and troubled brother are being questioned and threatened by Topolsky and Ariel over the disappearances and deaths of some local children whose fates were insanely similar to the children in Katurian stories.
Interesting.
I love that his name is Katurian, and they sort of insinuate that his middle name might also be Katurian.
Yeah, kind of a well, and there's a few tips of the hat to Catch 22, and because Catch 22 has a character
for sure. Major
who is a major, so he's major in that sort of absurdist. In the absurdist humor in the face of real horror, you know, because 22 is all about World War II. But the first
or
thing,
or like Humbert, weirdly too, is
doing
the same thing. Yeah. Humbert Humbert, I recently heard somebody say, and I went, no, yeah.
The first thing that strikes me about this play versus the others, and what I know of the others and his films, is that it isn't in a distinct time and place. It is a totalitarian state. We don't know where it is.
Sure.
We don't know when it is.
Right.
There's a timelessness that he sort of takes you out of it. So from the outset, you're not on terra firma in terms of processing what's happening, and so that as you process what's happening and as it becomes clear what's happening, it becomes even more horrifying, because the disturbing aspects you realize are universal. that sort of cross cultures and boundaries, you know? And I mean, it's very Kafka-esque. It's very sort of Russian author, you know, Dostoevsky kind of murkiness in terms of even the character names.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's what he's playing with, right? Because this is his first non-Irish play.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So he's purposefully doing that, obviously. Right. He's writing in somewhere else that he knows. And it's totalitarian, which fits in the sort of Russian sort of, as you're saying, like these authors were kind of writing about similar things and similar themes.
Mm-hmm.
This premiered at the Royal National Theatre in 2003 after reading at the Finborough Theatre in 1995. There's some really cool casts that have been in this. I'll bring that up later.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Oh, really I wrote cool. some down myself.
Some really, really cool ones. Really technically, cool. This is like part 10 of our Jim Broadbent miniseries.
Right.
Yeah. Which rules. The totalitarian thing is interesting. Let's start there, like with the world that they've built. Because we never really see the outside world. We get insinuations. It kind of reminded me of the Carol Churchill play Far Away.
Mm.
Where it's sort of like we're not really getting a lot of info about things outside of the room that we're in.
Right.
Which makes us feel like, are we in a real world? Are we in an absurd world? Are we in a, you know, what is this police state that we're
in? You know, I think about it now and it almost makes me think of Endgame a little bit.
Oh, sure.
The Beckett play? Yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
There's
or the Marvel
of...
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that sort of existential dehumanization, which becomes, in a way, kind of the springboard for what I think are his themes here. And the other thing that really struck me this time in reading, I've read it about 10, 15 years ago, shortly after it came out, so it had been a long time, but was... this idea of storytelling as a need, as an almost human biological need that is beyond meaning or interpretation. It's
sure.
as necessary. Every person in here in the play tells a story. Every person in here at some point is a storyteller, whether that story is the truth or a lie or something else, all, you know, we don't always know. But that the need to tell stories is as intrinsic a part of human existence as anything else, as eating, sleeping, fucking, as anything else. It's a need. Whether it's backed up by other stuff almost becomes irrelevant at some point. There's a
right.
We'll get to it in a little bit, but there's a line in here that I think is the thesis of the play in a lot of ways, but. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I feel like I took over.
Well, I mean, yeah. Did you guys have anything you wanted to say about the world, about the totalitarian society that we're in?
Oh, I just had something on the tip of my tongue. Hang on, did I write it down? Oh, yes. The thing that I connected with, and it's because I'm such a true crime nerd, is the thing that they talk about is all of the times in history when societies have gotten really into true crime or like morbid, weird, violent stuff. It's when there's bad shit going on around them. So, like, he's writing these stories out of having an abusive, awful childhood, but also he's writing these stories in the midst of a totalitarian state, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny, we're finding a lot of the comedy, the dark comedy of this piece is coming from how ridiculous, like, a police state is run.
Right.
Yeah. Like that's kind of what's amazingly funny about, especially the first scene and things like that. And there's this, you have your two cops and there's a good cop and a bad cop, ostensibly. The good cop of the good cop, bad cop is still very much a very bad cop.
Yes.
So it's like,
see, I think it's ACAB, the reverse.
Hashtag ACAB.
I think it's the reverse. I think the good cop is the bad cop and the bad cop is the good cop. Ariel is the only one that ends up having sort of a moral revelation.
That's true. No, that's true. I guess if you're speaking in terms of like who is an actual good cop or bad cop.
Sure.
But I think in the game of like good cop, we're playing good cop, bad cop.
Right.
Yeah. The good cop still sucks.
I thought Ariel was the bad cop physically because he's beating the shit out of everybody, but the other guy's like psychologically and mentally bad.
They're both bad.
Yeah.
They're both torturing him.
Well, and that's this it's this aspect of authoritarianism, and you know, I think, you know, he also sort of evokes, I read a review that talked about it feels like one of those 70s Eastern Bloc countries, like Romania in 1979, where it just fear perpetrating corruption, you know, was everywhere, because in authoritarian regimes, everybody becomes very, very protective of their fiefdom, and they find, you know, the power in their fiefdom. These guys walk down the hall, you have a feeling, and meet their superior, and all of a sudden they're two very different people. I got that sense, you know. And so that's just another thing that kind of, it ratchets up the tension. Like, the tension in this play is insane, which he does so well in Queen of Lenan. Is he ratchets up tension so well, almost easily, and you're like, your palms are fucking sweating. Like, last week it was what's his name with the fucking letters, like, just stay there and give the letter. And then this one, it's just like, just tell him what he want to know, just tell him what they want to know.
And he even plays with that even further with some of the short stories, right? There's the one story that's the mystery without a answer, where we which is so frustrating, but that's sort of what he's playing with too, right? And you know, we're talking about all these short stories are very interesting, and the Pillow Man being sort of the most scary, in my opinion.
But also, I think the character of Ariel even says there's something about that Pillow Man that I liked. There was something gentle in that. There's something that was kind in what the Pillow Man was trying to do.
But it's like when you hear about the little girls who were obsessed with Slender Man and they killed their friend.
Exactly.
Their friend. I don't think they killed her. But
they almost did.
Right. But there's that idea of them being like, no, we kind of fell in love with this entity. It doesn't exist, but like we're obsessed with it in some way. And there's like a beauty to it to them that was more than just like a game.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's lonely. We should be his friends. And he's telling us to do these things. It's like,
oh God. To back
he
up.
He loves cutting off fingers. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that you quoted that line. It's a puzzle without a solution. That's the line that I think is the thesis of this play, that's backed up by, I'm not trying to say anything at all. He's just writing. He's writing because he has the need to write, and not everything has meaning. Not everything ties together, but then sometimes it does, you know. I think, you know, I think he's playing with, you know, deconstructionism. He's almost challenging, you know, academia and psychology to kind of go ahead and break these fucking things down. But what you're going to find is at the core of it, this is still about the need to say things, the need to tell a story.
Yeah, I mean, in we talk about his evolution, right? And like his work in general, he really loves talking about legacy. Mm-hmm. And he really loves talking about what we leave behind.
Right, right. Mm-hmm, well, this is all about that.
Right, and I think what he's really talking about, whether in Beauty Queen of Lenan or this, is what we leave behind as artists more than anything.
Yeah.
And here he's a little more on the head about
But
well, like you said, Scott, go ahead.
I was just going to say Banshees of Inisherin. I think that's one of the major themes is legacy.
For sure.
And talking about what am I leaving? What happens when I go away?
Which is so funny because that script was something that he did not feel like he wanted to put out as part of his legacy until he was able to make it what he wanted to make it. Yeah, it's very interesting.
You can always come back to them plays, y'all.
Yeah. That's right. But as you were saying, Scott, this is about storytelling. It's about fairy tales. So, and it's about how regimes suppress writers. Mm-hmm. And if we're in the midst of the writers' strike. Okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And artists in general, SAG and everybody, right? But like, it's how regimes and we are in a regime, whether we want to like admit it or not. What we live in, this weird republic, amorphous democracy
corporate,
bullshit that we're
blah,
in
blah,
yeah
blah.
But the corporate regime That suppresses writers, the freedom of speech, freedom of expression, all these things. This is all very apparent here, but it's also about, in my opinion, how writers have a duty, both have a duty to their readers or viewers for a film or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. and the way that readers and viewers consume writers' work and how yes. you kind of lose that power in, like, I've put out this work and now people are consuming it and assuming that I am, like, this. Okay, here's an example, and this is personal, so I might cut this out, but I'll probably leave it. But my brother and I recently got in kind of a big fight because I sent him a script that I wrote that is purposely kind of dark and then ends up, like, really sticking the point at the end. Right. And he read, like, the first 5 pages and sent me an email that was like, you must have a parasite in your body to have written something this,
whoa,
this dark.
Wow.
And I was like, what? Now, there's a whole other thing I'm sure going on with him that, like, you know, I need to figure out and, like, talk out with him or whatever. But it was like, it really was this kind of, like, I was like, how did you not get this? And then I realized after talking to him more, like, oh, he didn't read very far.
Right, right.
So what he consumed of it, he was just like, Bailey, you're evil. Mm-hmm. If you're writing like this, you're evil.
Yeah.
And CJ, this was our script. This was CSWB's.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so, yeah, which we can talk about some other, but long story short, it's about Real Housewives who end up eating a drag queen.
Yeah.
That's the pitch. Yeah. And it starts, you know, kind of dark. It's dark. It's a dark script, but it's also fun and funny and makes a point, a very specific point. But he never got there. And so I have this, like, it makes me feel sick. It makes me feel sick as an artist that, like, somebody could watch 5 minutes of my thing and then turn it off and be like, that creator is evil. Right, and I'm not even going to consume the rest of this. And there's something about that here that really rung true with me. And obviously there's a wealth of themes here. And I don't know that we can tackle all of them in this discussion, much like he does not really tackle them in this play.
Right.
He just doesn't really
things about.
Yeah. He doesn't really answer anything. He's sort of like, which, sorry to, and I am mildly monologue, but this is the last thing I wanted to say is that I just saw Barbie.
Oh yeah.
And I also saw Oppenheimer. Uh-huh. And without giving anything away, both of them kind of do something similar where they, like, pose a million different sort of viewpoints and ideas and problems and concerns and themes. And then by the end are sort of like, we're not really going to put a bow on this. You get to sort of choose. You get to choose your form of feminism. We're not going to tell you any of it's wrong. That's what Barbie sort of is saying at the end, in my opinion. Or Oppenheimer is sort of about, like, I don't know. Like, especially in this political climate, like, it's all kind of fucked. Was he correct or not? Did he do it for the fame or not? Did he do it for the... And it's all sort of open-ended, but it's 3 hours of asking questions and not really putting a bow on it.
Well, it wants you to decide for yourself. Well.
Correct.
Yeah.
And McDonough does that well, and I love it.
Oh, absolutely. I so agree with that, Bailey. Absolutely. Yeah. You said the word consume and consumption, and it's something that you've talked about a lot recently in memory. I can't remember what we were talking about.
Andrew Lloyd Webber, people watching things irresponsibly. Oh, and
irresponsibly consuming Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah. Right. You know, and... Yeah, I don't think we can restrict any artist, you know, based on how somebody will interpret it. But Martin's definitely standing there pushing a big button, and that button and CJ and I talked about this ever so briefly last night. Child abuse. He's putting children's death and harm, and in some cases,
it made
torture.
It hard to read just because it's dead.
It is. And then he turns around and he'll come out of one of those stories, and then the dialogue is really funny. It's almost Python-esque. Like, like Terry Gilliam would have made this movie, like, you know, 20 years, you know, earlier, if it would have come out. Like, it's right up his alley in terms of exploring it, because it also it also, I kept thinking a lot because I'd read that he had, was inspired by his initial research of writing short stories and sort of exploring, you know, grim fairy tales and myths in general, that the level of cruelty that we seem to forget about because of the Disneyification of it, like Pinocchio's fucked up. It's a fucked up story.
They're all pretty fucked up.
You know, like he kills Jiminy Cricket with a mallet in the book, like smashes him to death. Like,
he's a bug. Like, bugs are gross.
Word. I don't like bugs. But but like, you know, Cinderella, Snow White, like these are all like dark and disturbing stories, and I think he plays with that so well, because I was thinking a lot about reading, like the first time I read like Roald Dahl stuff when I was a kid, before we knew about all of this anti-Semitism. But those stories are like Willy Wonka, excuse me, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is fucked up.
Yeah.
It's a fucked up dark story with a lot of, you know, poverty and torture and kids dying. And so it puts you at dis-ease right away. And then somehow, like, as a writer, he's able to pull you back into those characters and into those moments and release the valve really well. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah.
I do have a question as we segue into talking about the different productions, because one of the things that helped me a lot in reading this and rereading it was knowing that David Tennant had originated that role. And that Broadbent had been in as Topolsky in that. And I was like,
which also apparently was like a transcendent show. Like,
yes,
oh, yeah.
It's like legendary.
It's legendary, you know. Yeah. And they all got nominated. All of them did.
Yeah.
So when they went to do the American version, which had Jeff Goldblum as Topolsky and had what's
Billy
his name?
Crudup.
Billy Crudup as Caterian. Like, did they do accents?
Oh,
like
I don't think so.
They've just played it as American
and in fact, I think same thing with the Royal National. I think they did it in their own accents.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because when I read it in college, which we didn't really talk about that, but I remember reading this in college, and I did a scene from it, I want to say, or someone did. Maybe I wasn't in it. No, I was. I was Ariel.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. And the whole thing was, just do it in your, you know,
right.
Just do it how you would do it. And every clip I found, every trailer I found, because I was looking through YouTube videos of this and stuff, trying to find more info. And every one of them just did it in their regular accent. So
That makes sense.
It does. Yeah. It's just so, I found it so uniquely British, like I said at the beginning, in its rhythm and cadence and.
For sure.
That I was like, I don't know how I would approach it as a director, but fair enough. It would work. You know, you can make it work either way.
Right.
Okay. So here are your productions of this, right? You have the Finborough Theater reading in 1995, which also that same season included Shopping and Fucking by Mark Ravenhill, which is a good
thing. Oh, I've never heard that. Title. Is it awesome?
It rules. Shopping and Fucking is awesome. Okay. Check it out.
All right.
Yeah, it came out the same year, and it's very good. That cast. Oh, excuse me. It doesn't matter who that cast was. It does matter. I just don't know who it is. The premiere at the National Theater, which was directed by John Crowley, who directed the film Brooklyn more recently in 2015, which I loved. It's the Saoirse Ronan movie.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Quite good. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's great. And he did, he directed in 2000, he directed Come and Go, which was part of the Beckett on Film series. And he did a movie called Intermission, which is Colin Farrell and Cillian Murphy, and it's really fucking good. All
right.
Anyway, sorry, I like that guy. John Crowley directs. It's David Tennant as Katurian, mm-hmm. Jim Broadbent as Topolsky, uh-huh. Nigel Lindsay as Lindsay as Ariel, and Adam Godley as Michael, who you would maybe recognize from Love Actually is the first thing I always think okay. of. But yeah. he was in the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake. He's Charlie's dad, or he's one of the kids' dads.
Okay.
And he's might be Violet Beauregard's dad or something like that.
Okay, okay, okay.
He was in Theory of Everything. He's in a bunch of Umbrella yeah. Academy. He's on Umbrella Academy, which I know you like, Scott. Yeah. But anyway, he's good. He's the dude with the ears that stick out, and he's really funny. The New York production on Broadway at the Booth Theater in 2005 is also directed by John Crowley, but it is Billy Crudup as Katurian,
mm-hmm.
Who, you know, we haven't, I don't think we've ever talked about on this podcast, but he was in The Big Fish.
That's a solid career, man.
Yeah, it's
I know
career.
Him as he's the voice of Prince Ashitaka in the English dub of Princess Mononoke.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. He also is a 4-time Tony Award nominee. And his only win was for Tom Stoppard's play, The Coast of Utopia. Katurian, Billy Crudup, Topolsky, Jeff Goldblum.
Uh-huh.
Ariel was, I can never say this dude's name, but it's Jelko Ivanek, and he rules.
Okay.
He has a Primetime Emmy Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award, a Drama Desk Award, as well as 3 Tony Award nominations.
Damn.
You probably know him from... well, he's in 3 Billboards. He's in 7 Psychopaths.
Oh, okay.
He's in a bunch of Lars von Trier movies. He's on a ton of TV shows, like every TV show fucking right. ever. He was on Oz and 24 and fucking Hannibal. He's all over the place.
I haven't seen any of those.
You would know him if you saw him. You'd be like, oh, yeah, that guy. He's uh-huh. in the stuff.
Okay.
And then Michael Stuhlbarg, who I love, who is in the yeah. MCU. He's in all the... Doctor Strange movies.
Yeah.
I think he shows up in Endgame or Infinity War 1 All at right. one point, too.
Yeah.
He's in Arrival and a bunch of shit. I don't know. We love Michael Stuhlbarg. A Serious Man. One of my favorite.
Serious Man, yeah.
Joel and Ethan Coen movies.
Underrated. Really underrated.
I love that movie so much.
Yeah.
And then in Chicago... at the Steppenwolf Theater
this
in 2006.
Who's going to be in this cast then?
Amy Morton directs, and we have Jim Trufrost as Katurian, Tracy Letts.
Yep, that was one
as
I got
Topolsky.
Excited about. Yeah,
dope,
perfect.
Yes, Yasin Payankov as Ariel, and Big New York himself. I mean, excuse me, Big Chicago himself, Michael Shannon as Michael.
Right.
That's one of the most genius. Intriguing things. Like, because I would love to see him play Katurian, but the role
he'd be a great Katurian.
Yeah, but he'd still like. But he would kill that role because it's a tricky role too, and the way it's written makes it even harder because it's set up that he's going to be a certain way, and he is, but it's a tricky role.
It's tricky, yeah, for sure.
Right. And I know Trufrost, who played Katurian, I know him from The Wire.
Okay.
That's he's on all 5 seasons of The Wire. And then he was in August Osage County at Steppenwolf before it went to Broadway.
Okay.
And then was in it on Broadway. So he's, you know, he's a dude. And he's been in a bunch of
he's
stuff.
A dude.
I didn't know him that well. He's a guy. He's a dude. I'm a dude. He's
yeah,
a dude.
Yeah.
He's a dude. We're all dudes. Then in Paris, you have a fantastic a run that goes on in 2012. You get a Lithuanian run.
Yeah.
You get an Iranian run. You get an Irish run with
right.
Peter Campion as Katurian. Mm-hmm. That kind of
yeah.
rules.
Yeah,
that's fun. Kind of,
yeah.
Great Irish actor. And then Seoul got a run. Hong Kong got a run. Mexico, Argentina, Brisbane, Australia,
Brisbane?
Ankara, Turkey, Genoa.
So this play can go anywhere
Moscow.
And be in any fucking
yeah.
setting.
Madrid,
yeah, I mean,
Athens.
I There's that, like I said, it's that universality to it, and the darkness of it that it makes
everyone's just three decades away from fascism. So
right
now there was a London revival. I think this is worth mentioning because this year.
It just closed.
Nope, sorry, hasn't closed yet. Okay, it'll close in September. Okay. So it's got a few more weeks of run. If you're in London, go see it.
Let's go.
Directed by Matthew Dunster. Okay. And Couturian is played by Lily Allen.
Oh, I saw the website that they were advertising her specifically playing.
Which is interesting because she's a singer, right?
She's a pop singer, and then she has a talk show. She was in what's his name who's directing it? Also directed the original 222,
A Ghost Story, which was good.
Okay.
I saw that at Amundsen.
Right. Which she was in and got a lot of acclaim for, but apparently the reviews are basically like she just doesn't have the chops to pull this off.
Well, and some of the reviews, actually, I read one review that was like, honestly, she's great, but I saw the David Tennant one. And you're like, okay. And I think that's tough because I think that one had McDonough like there every day and was like very his brain. And this is like a whole new revival, a whole new thought process, whole new director who's not working directly with Martin.
Sure.
And I think maybe the show itself is not maybe on the same level. And there's just that kind of like, you know, when someone creates a role with the playwright like David Tennant did, it's sort of like, you know, it's just tough.
But I do love the
gender swap, though.
I really like the gender swapping, and you could do it with all of, like, can you imagine like Olivia Colman doing Topolsky?
Playing any of them. I want to see a show that it's just her playing all the characters.
And playing all of them, you know, but like, or a Jodie Whittaker playing Katarian. Like I would dig so much. You could do so much with it. And I think that's going to be the fun thing is to watch over the years as this show does get redone is
agreed.
Who tweaks with it and how do you tweak with it? And
the only, go ahead.
I was going to say the only character that might be a challenge would be Michael as a gender
maybe.
Swap, but you could still do it. Like do it.
You could figure something out.
Like, you know,
The last thing there's not a lot of relatable characters in this one.
No.
But I think it's less of a character study and more of a thematic study more than anything. He cuts a lot of fingers off. That's something else I want to make sure I said.
A lot of fingers.
In his plays, Banshees, he cuts fingers off.
Yeah,
this one's toes, right?
His toes.
That's true. Digits. He likes cutting the digits.
Cutting the digits.
But this is the last thing I want to say about it. It is a bit... And I've already read Hangman. Have you read Hangman yet?
I read all three of them in like 48 hours.
And I really loved Hangman. I'm excited to talk about it next week. But the biggest distinction I found was actually that this felt very of its time while I was reading it. It's 2003, and there's this thing that it's sort of a post Pulp Fiction, post like Reservoir Dogs, like Tarantino world. Where he's made a couple movies, and it's that thing a lot of playwrights and filmmakers are doing in the 2000s, that they're being subversive, but basically putting subversive words into the mouths of terrible people, and therefore like commenting on how terrible it is because, look, this terrible person saying these terrible things, but they're really just trying to be perverse and like sort of shock the audience.
Yeah.
But I was reading it sort of being like, and here comes the shocking. I get it. Yeah. You know, because I've seen so many things that are playing off of what this did.
Sure.
That it's like, I'm not saying he's playing off of it necessarily, but this thing has been ruined by a lot of 2000s filmmakers and playwrights.
I see what you're saying.
And so therefore, while I was reading Hangman, I started being like, damn, he has evolved. And so I'm excited to talk about that. I'm not saying Pillow Man is like a lesser play. You can just feel that he's outgrown that trend. Well,
it's 12 years apart. Like he's just
for sure
doing shit different.
For sure,
trying different
100%.
Things out. Doing shit the same too.
Absolutely. The other thing.
It's all dark comedy.
Yeah.
The other thing I think he's responding to in Pillow Man is the wake of Iraq, the wake of the torture accusations and all that. So
The world was, I mean, it's fucking insane now, but it was fucking insane back then too.
And some of it doesn't work. Like I remember seeing Sam Shepard's God of Carnage at the Geffen, which is direct response to the torturing of Iraqi prisoners. And it was, it just didn't work. It just fell sort of flat on its face. But But yeah, good point though, Bale. Noticing that in that time period, I see that. Yeah.
Are y'all have anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I just really enjoy. Like I'd never read it before. It was in the St. Louis Rep's Black Box season the year after I graduated. So in 2006, St. Louis did it. And I didn't. I was gone. I was in LA. So, but I just missed it.
Well, we have all of next week to really talk about the evolution itself, where we think he's ended up, where we think he's headed. I'd love to talk a little bit about his movies a little more next week if there's anything you guys want to get into about those. But besides that, I think we should get out of here. Do you guys have any L.A. spitlets?
L.A. Spotlight.
I don't have any right now. I'm kind of in between. I saw some shows over the weekend that are now going to be closed. But if it, just go out there and support people, y'all. Like, there's a lot of theater going on there. Go out there and see it.
I want to just shout out Crabs in a Bucket at Echo Theater Company. It's getting a lot of great buzz, like being a profoundly great play.
Oh, good.
And so I'm going to try and see
it. It's a great title.
Crabs in a Bucket by Bernardo Cubrera. Cubrera. And it's directed by Alana Dietz. And it's running July 15th through August 21st at the Echo Theater Company. You can find out more at echotheatercompany.com. But the raves are great. And maybe we should all do a little date together and go see it.
I feel like Echo does great shit, right?
Yeah, people love Echo. I like their space. It's small.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, they do good
stuff. Yeah, I don't have anything. See theater. We love you.
Yeah.
See shit.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for part two of three podcasts outside of Ebbing, Missouri. Join us next week for part three, and then we will be doing a...
Theater Nightmares.
Is that the very next one?
That's next.
Yeah.
Great. And then next is Theater Nightmare. Send them to us. We want to hear them. Send them on Instagram. Email us. It's all in the show notes. Siege.
Yeah. Send those to us. Email, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your fucking theme song. And if you don't agree with me, I'm going to cut off your toes. Ryan is a beautiful human being, and he's got a gig coming up soon. And I will get that information so that we can shout it out and plug his stuff. And then finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer or some sort of cocktail.
Yeah.
Please subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. And we love you guys. We'll see you next week for Hangman.
Yes.
Doses.
Hangman.
Tale as old as time. True as it can be.
Aw, Angela.
Barely even friends. Then somebody bends. Unexpectedly. Just a little change. Small to say the least. Both a little scared. Neither one prepared. Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, just remember out there, girls, find a boyfriend and fix him, and then you'll get married.
I love you, Angela Lansbury.
Maybe not.
And get a castle.
That's not what that's about.
And then it'll turn hot. That's
not what that's about.
Later, everybody.
The theater. The theater.
Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater.